Welcome to This Is Probably a Really Weird Question, the podcast where a medical doctor
and a doctor of history talk about sex, history, and the not at all weird questions we hear from patients, students, and colleagues about our bodies and our sexualities.
I'm Dr. Ronnie Hione.
And I'm Professor Rebecca Davis.
Welcome to the Really Weird Question minisode. These episodes are a series of conversations in which we talk with people who are spreading queer joy across the internet and lifting us up as the world continues to be not great. Today's guest is
Dr. Sammy Schock.
Just have to like send pictures of me sweating to my doctor. To
right.
Like,
upload them all to my chart.
Hey, Ronnie.
Hey, Rebecca.
How was your summer?
You know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, some really good things, some very challenging growth opportunities, but here we are. How are you? How's your summer been?
I think pretty much the same. The highlight of my summer, Ronnie, was I took the kids on a driving trip through New England, which is what my parents did with me when I was a kid to visit aunts and uncles and cousins. But my kids don't know these relatives quite as well. And so we're up in New Hampshire, and my cousin has this amazing house on a lake and a motorboat. And so he's got one of these big inflatable rafts that you pull behind the motorboat. And the kids go out and they have a great time. And then my 9-year-old is like, you got to come. Mommy, you got to do it. And so she and I he pulls us out on the raft. And we are like flying, and he's, you know, swerving back and forth. So we're like going in and off the wake. And like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. And as we're at one point, you know, we're holding on to the handlebars and our tushes keep, you know, flying off the seat, right? We're flying up and down on this thing. She looks at me with her hair back and goes, Sal, this is what I call mother-daughter bonding.
Oh my God.
And I was like, okay. You know, and so that in a nutshell was my summer. And that in a nutshell is everyday parenting this particular child.
You just made a core memory with your child. I love that story so much. I'm so proud of you for doing that.
Oh, you know, I will say I have been working really hard on the saying yes to things from the kids, because my oldest is 13 and a half, almost 14 this fall. And the time moves pretty quickly. So all the good parts of this summer came from saying yes to friends, to my kids, occasionally to my spouse.
Isn't that interesting?
No.
No, I meant, isn't that interesting to like how it multiplies your joy to say yes, right? Like when you like open yourself up to yes, that's just like opening yourself up to more opportunities for joy and pleasure.
Yes. I mean, Shonda Rhimes had this book, The Year of Yes, and her life is rather privileged, as you know, Shondaland is a special place where not all of us get to live. But the message of it really was like, you're exhausted, you're busy. The kid says, Mommy, will you just say yes? And just like how it changed friends saying, can you go on a trip with us this weekend? Just say yes. And like how her life changed by saying yes to things. So, yeah, we have another fabulous guest.
I'm kind of freaking out a little bit. Let's just be frank.
I know. I share it. I get it. I'm with you.
Guest, would you like to introduce yourself and let our listeners know who you are and what you do?
Yeah. Hello. Thanks for having me. My name is Sammy Schock. I am an associate professor of gender and women's studies at University of Wisconsin-Madison. I am an author of two books, Body Minds Reimagined, which is about disability, race, and gender in Black women's speculative fiction, and my new book, Black Disability Politics, which is about a history of Black folks engaging with disability as a political issue. I'm a writer, I'm an educator, I am an organizer, I'm a pleasure activist, and I identify as a fat, Black, queer, disabled femme.
Amazing. You know, I'm sure that many folks will know this about you as well, but you also successfully twerked on stage with Lizzo when she was here in Madison. I was in the audience at that show, and it was one of the most glorious things. It, like, the amount of joy in that venue was just over the top. It like blew the roof off.
Yeah, it feels like a million years ago. It was fall of 2019, which, you know, before times is, you know, a million years ago. But yeah, it was really, really a delightful, quite unexpected thing that now, yeah, gets brought up all of the time in my life. I think it will be on my gravestone.
Twerks with Lizzo.
So you probably know, Sammy, that after talking a little bit before we started recording, that this podcast talks about a lot of stuff. We cast our net very widely, and we talk about healthcare and history and gender and sexuality. And I'm curious about, is there something that you wish your healthcare provider would ask you, or is there a really good experience that you had in a healthcare setting that you want to share?
I think that I wish more healthcare providers would ask detailed questions rather than assuming questions. For me, that includes questions around birth control. At this point, after everything that happened with Roe, I went ahead and got an IUD because I don't trust Wisconsin to potentially provide me abortion care. So I was like, let's just go ahead and make this a long-term solution. But before I was on birth control on a consistent basis, you know, they would ask me who my partners were, and I date multiple non-binary people and have over the course of my life. And there's never questions about like who can or cannot get me pregnant, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of assumptions where people be just kind of slot me into queerness writ large or lesbian, not understanding that non-binary partners may also be people with penises. So I think asking a little more detail about like who partners are when thinking about things like STIs or pregnancy risks, and also really talking to people about what they want. I remember being in my 20s and really being pressured to come off of Depo-Provera because after a while, it can potentially cause sterilization. But no one asked me if I wanted to have kids. They were just like, you should come off it. You've been on it too long, which maybe there were other risks they weren't telling me. But the biggest thing they were pushing was, you know, maybe you want to have kids someday. So yeah, I think those things around reproduction have been a theme where I feel like if someone had just asked a couple more questions, I think there would have been a different approach.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. You know, our very first episode of this podcast was about the question, are you sexually active? And about how just ridiculous it is and how it just does not allow the opportunity for people to actually share what's going on in their lives. And, you know, in terms of sexuality and reproductive health, something that your book, Black Disability Politics, made me think a lot about is about how so I still provide obstetrical care. So I do family medicine with obstetrics. And one of the things that comes up is counseling around pregnancy care and kind of like intrapartum labor care, and thinking a lot about how disability is actually held up as a specter, which is a lot of what you talked about in your first praxis chapter, and how we counsel people about things like prenatal testing and how we counsel people about making decisions about their birth process, and how having a disabled child is really held up as this, like, you don't want to end up with a disabled child, right? Instead of working to create systems that actually allow disabled people to live full and authentic lives. So your book made me think a lot about my medical practice. So I thank you for that.
Yeah, there are a lot of folks in disability justice and reproductive justice movements who have taught me a lot about the various ways that we can approach this, right? Because I don't want folks to think that disability justice activists are like anti-abortion. That's not what we're doing. But being able to really provide folks with information and, yeah, just like educated and informed choices, including if you find out that your, you know, potential child has a disability or potentially has a disability, because some of these tests are not necessarily 100%, right? Not just getting that, here's a pamphlet, medical information, but being connected to families with kids with similar disabilities, adults with the same disability, so that you can see some possibilities for your child, because a lot of folks have such little exposure to people with disabilities or to the specific disability that's in question. So really balancing that, right, to be like, people have the option to make choices of whether or not to continue a pregnancy once learning about disability, because of course, we live in an ableist world that provides no support for parents of disabled children. It's very hard and it's very expensive. But there are also ableist ideas in people's heads about, well, this is what it's going to be like forever, or my child's never going to do XYZ thing, which may or may not be true. And so really connecting people with actual living human beings, disabled people who can say, here's what my life is like, here's what raising a child with this disability has been like, here are the resources that we use, can help people make a more informed decision. Yeah.
Cool. Is there a question that you hope never to hear from a medical provider ever again?
Yeah. Well, when I saw this in the, you know, the questions list ahead of time, it made me think of, I've only been asked this question once, but it really blew my mind, is I was with a provider and they were asking me if I exercise. And this was in the midst of what I eventually learned, I have a B12 deficiency. So I had gained like 50 pounds in a year and we couldn't really figure out what was going on. And I was having neuropathy and a whole bunch of other stuff. Eventually learned, yeah, my body just like was not getting B12. So I now have injections. But so she asked me, you know, are you exercising? And I was like, yeah, you know, I swim, I do Pilates. And the doctor said, well, do you actually break a sweat? And I was like, wow. Like, okay, like you really think that I'm telling you I'm exercising, but I'm like, not really? Or it was the wildest questions. Yeah, I hope no one ever says in response to someone saying, here are the exercises, here's the movement that I do in my life. And I'm saying, well, do you actually break a sweat? Do you actually let your heart rate raise? Like, oh no, I go to Pilates class and I just lay on the mat and I don't do anything.
I just glisten.
Yeah, that's how it works, right? That just the exercise enters your body.
Yeah, via osmosis. Just, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and this is someone that I had, you know, had worked with before, that I'm like, she knows that I am like a professor, a person with a PhD. And that was not that people without PhDs don't, but it was just such a bizarre question to me and just like deeply offensive. And then of course, to find out a couple months later after testing for a bunch of other things that I, yeah, had like dangerously low B12. And it took so long because the assumption was that I was just fat and not actually exercising, even though I said I was.
Yeah. Anti-fat bias in medicine is a real thing. And it is fascinating navigating the healthcare system as like a fat doctor. It is like, I feel like I should write a book about it sometime. It is fascinating. Not always awesome, but really interesting.
Hmm. Yeah.
And how about joy? As a pleasure activist, I suspect that you think about joy a lot. What gives you queer joy, or like any kind of joy for that matter?
Oh, and I don't want to interrupt. I don't actually know what a pleasure activist is.
Oh.
So I was hoping that you could, you know, in your answer also for the Luddites, you know, enlighten me.
Yeah. So the concept of pleasure activism, I learned from Adrienne Marie Brown. She has a book called Pleasure Activism. I have an essay in it, but I'd like to tell folks, you know, I was connected to Adrienne through work on Octavia Butler. We both do Octavia Butler kind of things. And she asked me to write about disability, polyamory, kink for this collection that she was doing. And so I did, but I didn't actually know what pleasure activism was. So it wasn't until the book came out and I was able to read the whole collection that I really understood. And so essentially, I like to say there's kind of like two main aspects of pleasure activism. First and foremost, it's an understanding that pleasure is political. Who has access to pleasure? Whose pleasure is criminalized, policed, valued, devalued? Who has the most access to pleasure is a political issue. Examples that I like to use is many years ago at this point, but it's one that sticks with me, is that these Black women were on a wine train in wine country in California and got kicked off for laughing too loud.
I remember that.
Yep. Yeah.
Right. So all of these moments where Black folks have had the cops called on them or harmed because of doing something that brings them pleasure that is not harming anyone else, right? We can also think about the concept of guilty pleasure, and things that are considered guilty pleasure are often things that are associated with working class folks or with women, right? So if you watch rom-coms, that's considered a guilty pleasure, but no one says going to the opera is my guilty pleasure, right? So how we value and rank what kind of pleasures are appropriate is based on these political value systems. So that's kind of the first aspect of pleasure activism, say actually pleasure is a political issue. It is shaped by our political and social landscape. So then the other aspect of that is kind of, what do we do? How does it become pleasure activism then? And that also kind of becomes twofold, where one, we think about how do we bring more pleasure into our lives, work on that like policeman in our own head that's like, ooh, why does that person like that? That's bad. That's wrong. There's something wrong with them, right? Really working on that, working on how we bring pleasure to our lives. But also if we are people who are in very privileged positions in this world, to think about how do we also support and bring forth pleasure for other people? So how do we make space for the pleasure of others? So I think that's also that working on the reducing the policing that happens in our own head of ourselves and others. And so doing that in individual lives, but also within our political movements. And I think that's something that Adrienne Murray Brown has really been emphasizing, is how do we bring pleasure to social justice movement? How do we make movement work pleasurable? Because so many of us get burnt out, get harmed, and leave, right? Give up, lose hope. And so bringing pleasure into these spaces is one of the ways that we make it sustainable. And we help people work on this resistance of pleasure in our lives and this belief that we have to work really hard, and showing that we're experiencing pleasure or sharing our pleasure is somehow like bad and wrong. So I think about the ways that in 2020 in the uprisings here in Madison, we often had music playing and people were dancing, and I brought food a lot of times. So we wanted to make it a space that people could not just come and express their righteous anger and their deep sadness and grief, but also the joy and the pleasure of coming together as a community and believing in the possibility of something else happening in this world. So pleasure activism brings these things together, understanding that pleasure is political, really working on that individual level of how we bring pleasure into our lives and think about pleasure in our lives and others, and then also bringing it to movement work to make liberation a pleasurable process. And I'll add that, you know, when Adrienne Murray Brown talks about pleasure, a lot of times people are thinking about sexual pleasure first and foremost. That's a part of it. It's not the only part of it. But she also talks about how her definition of pleasure is deep satisfaction. And I think that's important, because when I think about movement work, sometimes the pleasure is not the same pleasure as sex or as eating a delicious meal, but it's that success or that like relief that you feel where you're like, we did something. I think about the pleasure of, again, in 2020, when the Madison School Board voted to remove school resource officers, cops out of schools. And I was watching the Freedom Inc. live feed, and their youth squad, who had been working for years to make this happen, the absolute like joy that they had when that finally passed. And I'm like, it's one thing for one school, you know, and now the state's trying to make school officers a requirement for across the state, but that kind of deep satisfaction of like, we did it, and letting yourself really take pleasure in those moments is really important. So I like to remind folks that like pleasure is about this deep satisfaction that can sometimes come from things that aren't necessarily always happy, but, you know, potentially success, or even like allowing yourself to feel like having a really good, deep cry, which is really cathartic cry. I get a lot of pleasure out of that. Like there's a deep satisfaction in that release for me when I've been holding a lot of things in. So pleasure is really broad within the concept of pleasure activism. Is that helpful?
That was amazing. I loved everything that you just said, and I'm in.
Yeah, I'm ready to make liberation a pleasurable process. That's going to be my new mantra.
And of course, my little historian's brain was firing with like, you know, during the American War in Vietnam, you know, anti-war activists doing these like elaborate theatrical but goofy stunts, or queer activists dancing the can-can in front of police, you know, as they're raiding bars, and sort of thinking about all the ways that activists have brought joy and silliness and laughter into various serious forms of activism, and how that's not only about creating a spectacle, but also about nourishing themselves, and the way that laughter is so important to the cohesion that activist movements need, and that pleasure is so important to that. So that was amazing. So I think Ronnie had asked you about what brings you queer joy, or other forms of joy for that matter. But all I can think about now is like pleasure activism. But anyway.
Yeah. I mean, some things just coming back to this, like activists, you know, with the recent murder of O'Shea Sibley, who was a Black queer dancer, the protests that erupted after that and the folks showing up to the gas station where he was murdered, there were folks voguing, right, and dancing, doing the exact thing that he was murdered for and saying, absolutely not. We have a right to this pleasure in public space and we will not give this up, right? So watching those videos brought me so much queer joy alongside the sadness, right? Alongside the grief, alongside the reminder that being Black and queer in public is still dangerous, right? No one dancing at a gas station, right, should not be something that gets someone murdered. So that brought me joy recently. But I was also recently visiting family in Jamaica. And so I got to do a lot of swimming and like beautiful bodies of water. And I am a water baby through and through and through. I'm a Cancer sign. Like, I adore being in water, and the more naked in water, the better. And so I got to go swim at the Blue Hole, which is just outside of Ocho Rios in Jamaica. And it is this gorgeous blue swimming hole, super deep. Folks like jump off this waterfall and into the water. I'm not really a jump off a waterfall type, but I did go get into the swimming hole and just swim in this gorgeous water. And it just brought me, yeah, I think like an ancestral like pleasure that I was just like, this is the place that my people are from. And this is where, yeah, there's just like such a deep bodily joy in that space and in that water. And in general, just, yeah, every time I go to Jamaica, I'm in like 8 million different kinds of bodies of water. I'm like, I'll swim in a sea, in a pool, in a river, in a waterfall, in a swimming hole, in a lagoon, just like so much water. And that brings me immense joy. And I like to share those things, pictures and those things on social media. I think that's part of my pleasure activism, is just really sharing joy of being in my body in public spaces and private spaces, but just like really being myself in public, especially with, yeah, like wearing a bikini in public as a fat person, or really my fashion choices in general, as a part of my pleasure activism, to say I'm wearing this because it's what makes me happy and it brings me joy and it's my body. And that's it. That's all that matters, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, those are some things recently. I write a monthly column for Tone Madison called Pleasure Practices with Sammy Shock, where each month I write about something that is bringing me pleasure and encourage other folks to take it up. So this month it was popsicles, because I've been making homemade popsicles after I went down like a late night rabbit hole about making popsicles. And yeah, I've been eating a lot of popsicles. It's been a hot summer, despite today not being hot. It's been a hot summer, like early. So yeah, I've been eating a lot of popsicles, mostly strawberry. Yeah.
That sounds lovely. You know, I follow you on Instagram. And so I see the pictures that you put up of you kayaking and the videos of you kayaking. And kayaking had been like on my bucket list for a long time. And I was like, oh, I don't know, I'm like too clumsy and too fat. And then we went on vacation last week up to Door County. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to do the kayak. I'm going to do the bucket list. Like, Sammy Shock is out there paddling. I'm going to get out there and paddle. And it was amazing. It is so glorious and quiet. And like, it was so fantastic. So I need to find some places to paddle around here. There's no shortage, I'm sure.
Well, I need to go on vacation with you two, because my partner looks at those things and goes, why do people enjoy that? I made him go out in it once and he was like, okay, so we're done now, right? Like, I don't have to do this again, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is also a part of like embracing pleasure activism, to really recognize that the thing that brings you pleasure might not bring someone else pleasure, and that's fine. Something that brings someone else pleasure doesn't have to bring you pleasure. And that doesn't mean that it's a bad thing or a weird thing. I think we're so dismissive of other people's stuff, you know, because for me, I see people doing like high risk things, like I'm going to go parasailing. And I was like, ooh, no thanks. I'm not going to jump out. Like, I don't want anything. I like the most like slow, low risk activity. I'm an anxious person, you know? So to each their own, right? I like to emphasize that as long as someone's pleasure is not harming anyone, it's not causing harm, then leave it be. Just leave it be. Yeah, I love kayaking here. It really was a 2020 like pandemic occurrence where my partner and I rented a lake house to see my younger cousins because I hadn't seen them. And they happened to have kayaks at this house that we rented that was on a lake. And my partner's a big believer in using all the amenities. Wherever we go, got to use the amenities, got to get the most from your money. So they were like, we got to try them. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, I don't know. And then really, really liked it. Yeah, I also was like, I'm too fat. It's going to be too hard. I'm not sporty. I am not athletic. That's not my strong suit. But yeah, I really learned that it was something that I enjoyed. So here in Madison, I use Madison Boats. So they have docks at Brittingham and Marshall Boats, which is in Middleton, and Wingra. And you can just rent. You can go online, schedule, or walk up and rent a boat by the hour. And they push you in. They have a bunch of people who work there and push you in. And when you get back, they pull you out, which is great because getting in and out is like the hardest part of kayaking, I think. And at this point, I'm a member. So I pay for a membership so I can have unlimited kayaking. And yeah, this summer I did my longest solo kayak yet. I did a 4-hour kayak from Brittingham Boats all the way to Tenney Park and back. It was like over 6 miles and it was deeply, deeply satisfying. It was hard, but it was deeply satisfying to be like, wow, I didn't know that was a thing my body could do. Look at that, you know? And I think as a disabled person, I get really intimidated by a lot of physical activity. But I've been working up to it all summer and there was finally a day where my body was feeling good and the weather was right and the waves were right. It like wasn't too choppy on the water. And I was like, okay, this is it. This is the moment. And yeah, I did that. So
that's awesome.
It was really fun. Yeah.
Yeah, but did you break a sweat, Sammy?
Just have to like send pictures of me sweating to my doctor. To
right.
Like,
upload them all to my chart. Any organizations or people that are doing good work that you want to give a shout out to?
Oh my gosh, so many people. Well, I'm a big supporter of Freedom Inc. and of GSAFE locally. So Freedom Inc. is a Black and Southeast Asian queer and feminist organization that works primarily with low and no income folks. GSAFE works with our queer youth throughout the state. So those are orgs that I love to support. Outreach is our local queer organization that Pride is coming up next weekend here in Madison. We do an August Pride. And then I think Dana Pelabon locally is like a friend, but also just such a badass. She's the director of the Rape Crisis Center, and she's also a member of the county board. And I think she does amazing work and should be more appreciated in this city.
Awesome. We can add links to all of those in our show notes for today.
Awesome.
So you unquestionably have interesting reading habits. You know, you write about speculative fiction, you've done historical research. So like, what are the books on your bedside table or queued up on your Kindle or iPad or whatever? So what are you reading these days?
Yeah, I'm reading a couple of different things. I'm working on a new project. So I've got a couple of academic books that I've been reading. One is called Feels Right, which is about Black queer women partying in Chicago, like the party scene in Chicago. That's been a great book. One that I haven't started, but I bought to read soon is I Hope We Choose Love by Kai Chen Tom. It's a Asian Canadian, I believe, trans woman. I teach some of her work in my classes, and this is her new book of essays. And then I am in the thick of Janelle Monáe's The Memory Librarian, which is this collection of stories that she collaborated with a bunch of existing kind of speculative fiction authors to write stories within the world of Dirty Computer. So if you saw the emotion picture for the whole album, you know, it creates this whole world that we can kind of tell some things, but there's not a lot of detail. And this is like a book. So I started reading that when I was on the plane, and I'm really, really sucked into that right now. Also because I'm obsessed with Janelle Monáe and I want her to invite me to naked pool parties. And I think I'm close. She has shared two of my stories. They have seen my ass. So, you know, Janelle, if you're listening, I'm ready.
And talk about pleasure activism. Her most recent music videos are amazing.
They're wild.
Amazing. I mean, the whole album is literally called The Age of Pleasure. It feels very aligned with my work and with my path right now. I've been listening to the album just on loop constantly, and it's short. And I think some people feel like they want more, but I kind of love that it's short. It's 32, 31 minutes. And so I often use it as like, okay, girl, you need to just do a little bit of cleaning. Just put this album on and clean for 32 minutes. Then you can be done. You know, so I use it as like a way of marking, just like, here's a chunk of time to go do this one task. And then the album will be done and you'll know that that half hour has passed. But yeah, incredible work. And so, yeah, I think this book came out last year, and it's hard for me to get too much like fiction pleasure reading these days with the other work that I'm doing. But this was one that I wanted to really get to. So I've been, reading that one.
I think this was from her prior album, where her outfit is basically a vulva.
Yeah, that's from Dirty Computer. So that's the first,
I was like, why is it taking this long? Like, why, why is she the first? Like, this is such an obvious, like, gorgeous, amazing performance. So I'm a fan too. She's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, they just performed in somewhere in California this week because they were sharing a bunch of images. And they had the pants back on for a performance of Pink. So the pants made a reappearance.
And have I misgendered Janelle Monáe?
Oh, she and they. So yeah, okay. Janelle Monáe came out as non-binary, I think, if not early this year, last year, and has, really come out about queerness and non-binary, and most recently came out as also polyamorous. There's a poly song on the new album called Only Have Eyes for Two, which is, oh my gosh, what a deeply satisfying, I sent it to every poly person I know. I was like, we finally have a song, and not like a political song that's like, everybody can love multiple people, but just like a sexy poly song.
Yes.
It's such a good song. It's so clever. Yeah. I had a whole of the pleasure practices article that I did. I did a whole one just on
of
that
course.
Album.
Amazing.
So incredible. You know, I'm going to go back to like a little bit of a conversation that we were having previously about your book and kind of some overlaps that I really found helpful while I was reading it. I was thinking a lot about psychiatry and your chapter about psychiatry and how it has been used to oppress and harm people. And as somebody, again, who does a ton of trans health, it is an enormous part of my practice, like people trying to get the care that they need and not having access to the mental health care that they need. And then on top of that, I oftentimes feel like I become a tool of the state, right? Whether it's because I have to write letters of support for gender care or even somebody who needs a work note, right? Like I don't need a work note, but I also am an upper middle class white woman who's working in academia. But the people who need work notes are like the person working at the Quick Trip. And so how we become either intentionally or unintentionally just like tools of oppression instead of healing is something that I've been thinking a lot about since reading your book.
Yeah, absolutely. Not quite to the same degree, but you know, in my teaching, when I have these moments where I'm like, oh, I really am like constricted by this institution that I'm within, I try to at least name to my students, I'm like, okay, here's the wiggle room that I have to give you. And there's the wall. And I can't move that wall, but I can tell you that I think it's wrong. I can at least acknowledge that what we have to do here isn't right, even if I don't necessarily have the capacity to change it, which I think at least helps a little bit for people to be like, okay, at least we all are on the same page here, even if we can't change it. But yeah, when you were talking, I was thinking about that law that Missouri ultimately did not get passed, where they were trying to say that trans folks who had pre-existing mental health conditions of any sort were like not allowed to get access to transition care unless that was resolved first, as if you cannot have any kind of psych disability and be trans.
Right.
So that was one where I was like, oh my gosh, the levels of like psychiatric like negotiation and abuse that can happen within these. And they even included autism in the list. So then it just meant that autistic trans people weren't going to be able to get any transition care. But that did not pass. But the fact that it was even attempted and that all these people had to quickly scramble to potentially adjust until it got shut down was wild. And just, I think, another example of the way that psychiatry can be used by the state in really abusive ways, whether or not the folks working within it, you know, agree with that or are trying to be resistant to it.
Yeah, it is a very bizarre place to be. I think that's similar to like what you're talking about when you are describing the wall and then you're like creating space between yourself and the wall all the time. I'm like, I'm really sorry that I have to do X, Y, or Z, right? Like I have to use the gender dysphoria code when I am coding your visit for today. Here's why I think it sucks. And if you want to give feedback to the university, here's how you can give feedback to the university about it. All right. So going back to some joy, tell us about your queer icons, like living or dead. Who are your queer icons and why?
Janelle Monáe. Mm-hmm.
Noted.
100% Janelle Monáe. Yeah, really, really important to me on a lot of levels. You know, Audre Lorde has had incredible impacts on me as a young person. You know, I think Audre Lorde and bell hooks were the first kind of Black feminist theory that I read. And I feel like every time I reread Lorde to teach, something else stands out that I missed the first time. I think even her essays have this poetic quality that just, you know, depending on where I am in my life and what's going on, just different things stand out to me and move me in new ways. So I have like Audre Lorde quotes in various locations around my home. So those are two that are particularly kind of like important. I also have a lot of Octavia Butler stuff. She is not officially queer. She is read as queer. There's nothing, you know, she did not claim a queer identity in life, but there's something about her very like pessimistic hermit nature while still holding on to hope and her like embrace of, you know, like Black female masculinity. She was a tall, dark skin, deep voice, Black woman who prioritized herself and her career. You know, she didn't really have a lot of relationships in her journals and in her papers as part of the research for my first book. And I just loved reading these entries where she would be like, I guess I could have a husband, but I would need like all of these things for him to like go away when I needed to write and do my work. And I'm like, yes, girl. Like, so it just, it has this like queer vibe to me. But I try to make clear to folks, because I think people try to claim her as queer or as lesbian simply because she is more masculine presenting, which I'm like, let's not make that assumption about people. There's no like official, but I think there are ways that she has queerness in this broad way, right? I think for me, queerness is a very broad category that is not simply about who we have sex with.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I just basically move out of my house when I have to do a lot of writing. But the separation is necessary. Yeah. Very much so. So this is a question that is a little out of the ordinary, but we have enjoyed hearing people's responses to it, which is, do you have any favorite daily rituals? And if you do, like, what is it about them that you like or that brings you pleasure, I suppose?
I don't know that there's anything I do every single day, but many days, most days, I make a smoothie in the morning, like a green smoothie. It's been something I've been doing for years and years and years. And honestly, it's because I can be like, did it. I ate some vegetables, fruit, done. Whatever else I do today, I already did that. And it's just a way where I feel like, okay, you know, it gets things moving in the morning. And it pretty consistently, I have the supplies to make some sort of green smoothie that's like whatever fruit is in season, or frozen fruit if I don't have fresh fruit, and carrot juice that I like to put in it, and spinach. And yeah, I do a green smoothie as a way of just being like, okay, at bare minimum, you have gotten one serving of both of those things and maybe you won't get scurvy, because I get a little distracted sometimes and then I don't eat until it's dire. And so it's just like whatever I can immediately put in my mouth. I'm bad at like meal planning and that sort of thing. Same. So yeah, a green smoothie in the morning is definitely one of the things that I do relatively consistently. But yeah, I have like school year routines, and then I have like not being in school routines. As a 37-year-old adult, I still, you know, live on the school year schedule. And so what I do in the summer is very different than what I do during the school year.
And public service announcement to our listeners, frozen fruit has all the same nutritional benefits as fresh fruit and is always cheaper. Fresh produce is so expensive and so out of reach for so many folks. And so I am a huge proponent of frozen fruit because it is harvested and frozen at the peak of its freshness. I've been thinking a lot about like how people feel like they're cheating, or big air quotes, like, oh, if I eat a salad with salad dressing, it doesn't count. Like, what does that really mean? Like,
I never understood what that
meant. Yeah, I know, right? It's like all that weird programming that we've gotten for so long, right? So get the frozen fruit. It is delicious.
Mm-hmm. I always have a bag of, it's typically like a tropical fruit mix. I like a mango in there mixed in. And then I also keep frozen spinach in the house because same thing. Like, you don't have to chop and cook down a bunch of spinach. You can just throw some frozen spinach out of a bag and it is the same nutritional value with less work. There's a lot of disabled activists who talk about when people make fun of some of these quicker options that it's actually, it is what works for a lot of disabled folks, that like chopping and peeling a bunch of fruit is not accessible to a lot of people, either physically accessible or time-wise, capacity-wise, whatever that might be. So yeah, I love that you added that in there because I absolutely, you know, I like a banana. Some people don't like bananas. So I do keep bananas around, but a lot of times, yeah, I'm pulling from that big old bag of frozen fruit.
Yeah. Do you know about Black Girl Lost Keys?
I do.
She has this amazing, I have actually linked it in a lot of my like patient instructions that I just have copied to make it easier. She did this amazing post about how to like feed yourself when you just can't, right? Like, and she has all of these really amazing suggestions about like, if you don't have the spoons to feed yourself and you need to feed yourself, here are some things that you can do. And like, don't feel guilty about it, right? You're doing the best that you can when you're like struggling because of mental health or physical health. These are ways that you can take care of your body.
Yeah, I have a running list of the things to remind myself when I'm in a depressive episode. Like, here are your safe and easy quick foods. A friend of mine introduced me to powdered vegetables, which are marketed as ways to get vegetables into children. But when you are struggling, if you're just going to make a bowl of ramen, you can sprinkle some of the powdered vegetables on it and add a little bit of more nutrition into the carbo load that you're making quick and easy for yourself. So yeah, I use all kinds of things because my capacity really varies. And it is much higher in the summer. I do so much cooking in the summer. It's also when I'm not teaching, which I think is related, but I have seasonal depression. So in the winter, especially hard winters, it's really hard for me to figure out feeding myself. And so the more that I have easy access things and just literally a list of like, these are things that you can do to remind myself when I'm like lying on my couch being like, I'm hungry and I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a real, really weird question for us? And it's okay if you don't.
I don't think so. Here's the thing. My perception of what is weird, I think, is very, like, I just don't find very many things weird. I'm like, that makes sense to me. You know,
same.
The things that people find weird, I feel like I can always find a rationale for why that thing might be, like, the case for that. And so, yeah, there was a point where I was hanging out with my younger cousins and I was like, I love you little weirdos. And one of them kind of looked at me and I was like, oh no, that's a good thing. I like that you're weird. I think it's great. Like, I think being outside the norm is wonderful. So I think it's hard for me to imagine a really weird question because there's just not, like, sure, there's probably weird things I could ask that would be weird to other people, but I don't, for me, not so much. I think, yeah.
That's actually a beautiful thing to be like, you know, I don't really think much stuff is weird, which is, it serves me well as a physician, let me tell you.
Yeah, I try to approach things with a lot of curiosity. I think it helps that I've been a part of like poly and kink communities for so long that I've seen a lot of things and I'm like, huh, never seen that before, but clearly it makes you very happy. So, okay, you know, yeah, I've just seen a lot.
Thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom, and I'm feeling a lot of joy right now. So I think it's really special when you have that ability to convey that, you know, over Zoom. And I mean, what you were explaining was in fact quite complex, but you're sort of a brilliant communicator, which comes through, of course, in all of your books and all your public writing. But to experience that in the moment Was sort of exhilarating. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a great time. Thanks for having me.
We have some late breaking news.
Ooh, tell me more.
Since the recording of this episode, Dr. Sammy Shaw, in fact, did twerk with Janelle Monáe live on stage.
Amazing. Legend.
Such a legend. Achievement unlocked. Thank you for listening to this breaking news update. You've been listening to This Is Probably a Really Weird Question, which is created, hosted, and produced by Rebecca Davis and Ronnie Hayon.
You can learn more about us, read our show notes, and find links to resources on our website, www.reallyweirdquestion.com.
Follow us on Instagram at reallyweirdquestionpod.
Send us your really weird, not really, questions by emailing us at reallyweirdquestion@gmail.com.
Nora Carlson is our website guru and social manager.
Mick Finnegan is our sound engineer.
Mark Wurzelbacher composed and recorded our incredible theme music.
We are grateful for the financial support of the Phil Zwickler Charitable and Memorial Foundation Trust. We additionally thank the Foundation for Delaware County.
Please rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts to help other people find us in their feed.
Our website is also where you can find links to our fabulous merch, which helps support the show.
Thank you for listening, and keep on asking those questions.